All right, we're ready for Mark chapter 6. We have some ground to cover, and so we want to get underway. This is our outline we're following from Brother Stouffer in his work, excellent work on the book of Mark. And we are in the Galilean ministry. We're in chapter 6. This will continue through chapter 8. And then we shift gears as he moves toward Judea. And so anyway, we're in the Galilean ministry. As he subdivides that in his work, we're in this section of identity and then moving to the confession section. In that last section, we'll talk more about that in a moment. That's driving toward chapter 8, that confession that was made that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of the living God. We're now in that section on identity, and as he labels it here, and we'll be in that for the first six verses of chapter 6, and we'll say more about that here in a moment. Let's review where we've been. Chapter 1. Yes, that's where the Galilean ministry began. Matthew began in chapter 4. Chapter 2. Yeah, conflict. He moved quickly. Remember, Mark is a fast-paced writer where he just moves from point to point quickly. And he moved quickly to the conflict that began to build. Chapter 3 dealt with the Sabbath controversy over the matter of healing. Chapter 4, parables. And that was in chapter 13 to kind of give a comparison how quickly Mark is getting to these points. Then chapter 5 last time dealt with three miracles. And now chapter 6, question number 1. What's the main point of chapter 6? All right. Say again.
Unbelief.
Something else I hadn't heard yet. John beheaded. It's a major event. These are all good points. I call the chapter John Beheaded and Miracles. This was a major, significant circumstance wherein John was beheaded and the reason he was beheaded. Chapter 14 of Matthew, if you want to get a comparison of how quickly Mark got to this, we're there at chapter 6, took 14 chapters for Matthew to get there. So here's what we have in Mark 6. We have John beheaded, and the miracles. We have Jesus rejected at Nazareth, chapter 6, verses 1 to 6. We have 12 sent out on the limited commission, verses 7 to 13. John the Baptist beheaded. And then there are miracles that are mentioned here. That is the feeding of the 5,000, Jesus walking on water, and then the description of many being healed. No specifics given there other than many came to him and they were healed. Not a specific person being dealt with is my point there. All right, let's go to question number 2. Why was Jesus rejected at Nazareth? Yeah. He's one of their own. And Jesus makes a point about that, that a prophet is not without honor except in his own country. That's a general principle that even applies to our own day and time. We'll say more about that in a moment. Plus, if Luke is the parallel account to this, big question, we'll talk about that in a moment. It was because in that event, in Luke, he claimed to be the fulfillment of Old Testament prophecy. And there is a question of whether Luke is parallel here. All right, let's get underway. We're talking about Jesus being rejected at Nazareth. Nazareth is not mentioned here in this account, but Jesus is already preaching in Galilee. This is his Galilean ministry. His hometown where he was raised is Lazarus. And so now verse 1 talks about he came to his own country. And if Luke be parallel, we're talking about the city of Nazareth. So he came to his own, the region of Nazareth, and we're going to see that they rejected him. Now, I want to look at the parallel account just for a moment. We're going to look at this several times. If you're trying to copy that, you would be better to ask to send me an email and sign up for the emails where you have a copy of these. So you don't have to copy this down or just make a picture of it with your phone, whatever. But you're going to see this several times. But we have Mark's account and then Matthew's parallel account and then Luke's parallel account. But I put Luke in red because that may not be parallel. And we'll say more about that here in just a moment. But, well, let me go ahead and say something about Luke. Luke's account, I'm not sure if it's parallel. A.T. Robertson argues that Luke was not the same. Luke's account in Luke 4 is not the same as Matthew and Mark's account. And so does Stouffer argue the same thing, that Luke 4 was early in the Galilean ministry. And there are different events that take place there, such as he was given the book and he was asked to read from the book of Isaiah, and he read it, and then he closed the book, handed it back, and said that he was, and I'm paraphrasing, I am the fulfillment of the prophecy. Could that have fit here? Surely it could fit here. But they both argue that Luke is early in the Galilean ministry, Mark 6 and Matthew chapter 13 is late in the Galilean ministry and not the same. Now, for what that may be worth to us, I'm not sure, but here is a quote from Robertson. He said, there's no sufficient occasion to identify the visit of Nazareth with that described by Luke. This was at the very beginning of the great ministry in Galilee, and this was near its close. The details are quite different, and he's talking about the opening of the book is what he's talking about there. I won't read the rest of that, but his point here is that case is different. I'm not sure about that. It very well may be. I kind of think maybe they have a point. I'm not sure. They do seem to be parallel in a great deal. And I'll point out where the details of Luke may plug in here as we go through this. But anyway, let's go through this verses 1 to 6. That on the Sabbath day, he began to teach in the synagogue. Well, that's what happened in Luke's account as well. And what kind of reaction did they have? All right. They're amazed because they said, where did this man get these things? And with what wisdom is this which is given to him and the mighty works that are performed? So they're alluding to the works, the miracles he's performed, and the wisdom with which he taught. This is not like a rabbi, a typical rabbi or a scribe. This is what kind of special wisdom has been given to this man that he teaches in this manner. And they're astonished and amazed. This, I thought, was the son of Mary. He's the carpenter, the son of Mary, the brother of James, Joseph, and Judas and Simon, and his sisters. In other words, we know the whole family. Now, Mark doesn't mention Joseph. Matthew does. Doesn't mention him by name, but mention him, Jesus being the carpenter's son. And so why did he not mention him? I don't know. We're not told. It's at this point where if Luke is parallel, it plugs in. Because when they raise the same question in Luke, that's what makes me think, kind of go back to that it may be parallel. It was at this point when Jesus said, I'm the fulfillment of prophecy, that they can't accept we knew this guy. He grew up here. We know his family. We know his father. We know his mother. We know his sisters, and we know his brother. We know the whole family. And he grew up here. This could not be the fulfillment of the prophet that he's reading from. Does that make sense? So it very well may be parallel. That's where it would plug in if they indeed are parallel. And they were offended at him. In other words, they didn't accept that. Now, Jesus makes this point at verse 4, a prophet is not without honor except in his own country, among those of his own relative, those of his own household. What's that mean? Yeah, this is the boy that grew up right here. I once worked with a church where we had an elder there that was old enough he already had grandchildren, but there was an element in the church, couldn't accept him. They wouldn't accept him. And he had grown kids, he had grandkids, but he's just a kid. What do you mean he's just a kid? Well, I remember babysitting and changing his diapers. See, they never let him grow up. He's just a kid in our eyes. I remember babysitting. I remember him playing in the yard. I remember babysitting him, and he's just a kid. They never let him grow up. I think that's part of the point Jesus is making, that hometown people don't accept him. We knew him. I knew him when he was growing up. They never let him grow up. And a prophet is not without honor, except in his own country, Jesus said. Now, he did not do many works. Now, verse 5 deserves some comment. That he could not do mighty works there. except that he laid hand on a few sick people and he healed them. In other words, while he's in Nazareth in the region, he could not do many works. Now, why is that? Well, verse 6 explains, and so does Matthew's parallel account. He marveled because of their unbelief. I'll come back to that. But Matthew 13:58 says it was because of their unbelief that he could not work miracles. So does that mean that they had to have faith for Jesus to work miracles? No, that's not the point. I think the point is they were not bringing their sick to him to be healed because they didn't believe. That's the point. Could Jesus work a miracle? Sure he could, whether they believe or not. And he did on occasions. So why didn't he work a lot of miracles at Nazareth? Because of their unbelief. They were not bringing their sick to him like they did in other regions. Make sense? So Jesus marveled at their unbelief. To my knowledge, that's the only time that phrase is used with reference to unbelief. I may be wrong, but I think I'm right about that. That's the only time that phrase is used. He marveled at their unbelief. There's another time Jesus marveled at faith. In other words, there are varying degrees of faith, but he marveled at the degree of faith. There are a number of people who may disbelieve, but he marveled at their disbelief. Suppose why he marveled. Reckon why. This was so amazing. There was other occasions of disbelief. He knew these people. These were his own people. John 1 said he came into his own and his own received him not. It's more of a thought question. I'm not looking for one particular answer. They're going to reject him anyway. He's hometown boy, grew up here, and that we knew his mom and daddy. He can't be the man he claims to be. And so he marveled at their unbelief. This is amazing. And then he went about in the villages in a circuit teaching. That simply means he went from city to city to city teaching in the area, in the region, in the suburbs, or in the region around Nazareth. Make sense? He was rejected among his own. That's the point to be seen. All right. Now let's move on to the next section. And let's go to question number 3. What were the disciples not to take? Why were the disciples not to take the things mentioned in verse 8 with them? All right. Things are going to be provided for them. All right, very good. We'll come back to that. Now, we're beginning at verse 7, and I just wanted to flag our outline that we're following. We're shifting gears according to the outline we're following anyway. We're moving toward that confession and driving toward that in chapter 8. So we're shifting gears just a little bit here. So beginning at verse 7, the 12 are sent out on the limited commission. Now, the parallel accounts to that, in the second line, we have John doesn't mention this, Matthew does, and so does Luke. Luke has 6 verses, but I want to go back to Matthew just for a moment. We don't have time to read it. We don't have time to give the details. What I want you to see is Matthew gives us more details than does Mark. And you say, like what? Well, let's go over there and take just a quick glance at Matthew chapter 10. Matthew 10 identifies the names of the apostles going forth. Starting at verse 5, he sends them out. Might keep a finger there. We're going to make some comparisons in a moment to the things they took. And then Jesus explains to them the persecution they're going to face, beginning at verse 16, and how they handle that, and the effect of their message. It may bring division, verses 34 to 39, etc. And then the report comes back when they have finished that back in chapter 11 in verse 1. All I want you to see at this point is there is more in Matthew than we have here in Mark. Make sense? All right. Now let's make some comparison here. As we look at these two accounts, let's go back now, and we're focusing on the 12 being sent out on the limited commission. First of all, he called the 12 to them that he's already named, Matthew 10, and sends them out 2 by 2. Now, we're not told why he sent them out 2 by 2. It could be for security. It could be for comfort and for strength, that is, the encouragement you get as you go forth with a companion to go. Some have suggested maybe it's based on the Old Testament principle that at the mouth of two or three witnesses, every word may be established. So as two are giving testimony about Jesus and his message, whatever reason, I'm not told, the text doesn't tell us. And he gave them power over unclean spirits. Now then we get to verse 8, what they were to carry with them. And notice that they were to take nothing for their journey except a staff, no bag, no bread, no copper for their belts, but to wear sandals, and they were not to take to put on two tunics. And let's stop there for a moment. What does that suggest? Well, they were to be supported of those they were teaching. You go teach, and you're to be supported, and you'll be fed and clothed and taken care of. Again, the laborer is worthy of his hire. That's a test of their faith. You go forth. Don't take all your provisions with you. You'll be taken care of by those that you go teach. Now, if they then say, well, no, Jesus, we're going to take all of our provision because we don't trust that. They don't have much faith, do they? So it is a test of their faith. But I'm more interested at this point of how Matthew's account differs from Mark's account. And they are different. And so how do we explain that? Matthew's account, and Matthew says, do not take a staff and do not take sandals. Your translation may say shoes. It's a different word. I'm not sure that's a big significant difference, but it may be. But do not take a staff and do not take sandals. Mark's account says take a staff and take sandals. Sounds like the opposite. Stouffer suggests maybe these are two different aspects of this same commission. One when they went into Galilee, another when they went into Judea. I'm not convinced of that. I didn't see any evidence of that. He didn't provide any, and I didn't see any anywhere else. I think a more logical explanation and the harmony of that is that they may take a staff that they already have, but they were not to acquire an additional staff. The word in Matthew 10 and verse 10, to provide, means to acquire. Linsky argues that. So does Bible Knowledge Commentary argue that. Whereas the word, it's a different word in Mark of taking, doesn't mean to give the idea of acquiring. So whatever staff you have, you take with you, but don't acquire more. The sandal is the same principle, Linsky argues, that whatever sandals you have on your feet, but don't acquire more sandals. You can take those sandals with you, but don't acquire more. That makes more sense than one commentator kind of left it, said, I don't know how to explain this. I'm not sure what the difference is. I believe there is an explanation. That one makes more sense than going in two different regions to me. But there is harmony in that. But here's what they could carry and here's what they could not carry. Now, at verse 10, whatever place they enter, they were to stay until they depart. In other words, you're being supported. What's verse 11 saying? Whoever will not receive, depart, shake the dust off of your feet. Yeah, as a Jew would go into Gentile territory, the custom, I'm told, would be as they come out of that territory to shake their garments, shake their feet, and get the dust so that they are symbolically removing the contamination of the Gentile and the pagan from them. And it was a symbol of disassociating themselves from the Gentile. So we've been among Gentiles. We're shaking that all off. We're disassociating ourselves. We don't want to be identified with pagans. Yeah, so that's the point. Here's the point here. Don't waste your time on unfertile soil. Is there ever a time you just give up and move on? Maybe come back again and try. But you're trying to teach somebody, and you're trying to teach somebody, they keep rejecting. Move on. Don't waste time on unfertile soil. It's a waste of time. They're not listening. They're not interested. Move on and go on to somewhere else. That's the point. So they went out and preached the gospel, and verse 13 needs a little attention. And they cast out many demons and anointed with oil many who were sick. Luke 10 suggests that the anointing of oil had medicinal impact and was used away from miracles. It was used for medicinal purposes. So it seemed to be more symbolic here. Not that there was power in the oil, that the apostles needed the oil. and without the oil, you couldn't work the miracle, but symbolizing that this is going to heal, and with a miracle, then they heal. Does that make sense? I don't see any association with oil that the miraculous power was in the oil, and if we lost our oil, we can't work miracles. I don't know what we're going to do. We've lost our oil. But it seemed to be symbolic of a healing process. All right. Now, the report, how that went, is going to come later. We're not there yet. We're going to see it before we get through. Any questions on the 12 being sent out? All right, let's talk about John the Baptist. Back up a little bit. We're ready for point three, John the Baptist being beheaded, beginning at verse 14. Now, there's some key players here concerning Herod, Herodias, and her daughter. So we've seen this little chart before, and so let's get a little bearing of who we're talking about. We often talk about Herod the Great. That's not this Herod. We're going to get to the Herod. In fact, let's go ahead and get to our Herod we're talking about. We're talking about Herod Antipas. You might make a marginal note. Might be helpful for future study. This is Herod Antipas. He was king of a ruler of Galilee and Perea. So that's why he's the man that we're dealing with here. All right. He was the son of Herod the Great. Now, Herod the Great had many wives, and from one of those wives right here, he had a son named Herod Antipas. There was another son that he had by another wife whose name was Philip. So he'd be a half-brother to Herod Antipas. This is Philip right here. Here's Herod Antipas, who was married to this woman named Herodias. And so Herodias is a player here in the story. And he had taken the woman who had been married to his brother, enticed her, and she now is married to Herod Antipas in our story. There's another person mentioned here who's not named, and that's the daughter, Salome. Those are the three key players here, and John the Baptist, which we already know. Make sense? All right. With that in mind, let's get underway looking at the story of John the Baptist. Now, the parallel accounts, there's a parallel account in Matthew 14. Luke doesn't say much, only three verses. Luke 9, verses 7 to 9, for what that may be worth to us. All right, let's talk about what we learn here, and we'll come back to our questions about that here in a moment. Herod heard, again, that's Herod Antipas, of him, that is, he heard about Jesus, for his name had become well known, and he said, what was his reaction to that? This has got to be John the Baptist whom I beheaded. Luke 9, in verse 9, said Herod wanted to go see him. He heard about this, I've got to go see him. Now, let's pause for a question here. Question 8, what did Herod think about John? This is why he would have thought about John. He was a just man. He was a holy man. He did many things because of him and heard him gladly. He had respect for John. Had too much pride, though, not to kill him because he got himself in a bind. We'll get to in a moment. With an oath he should not have ever made. But be that as it may, he's got himself in a bind there. But he did have some respect for him, recognized this was a just, a holy man, a man of God. And when he had him beheaded, then he hears a report about miracles. This may be that John the Baptist whom I beheaded. Throws from there, I won't go see him, Luke 9 said. Absolutely, absolutely. To think that maybe he's raised from the dead, and yet he's a stubborn person, as we see in this context. Now, let's go to verse 17. He had laid hold of him, and here's why, and we're going to come back to this. You might make a marginal note. This has nothing to do with the direct story. This is about 28 A.D. That harmonizes with dates we flagged back in Matthew. 28 A.D. is when this probably is taking place. But verse 17, get ready to underline, that he put him in prison for Herodias' sake, his brother Philip's wife, for he had, might underline the word, married her. There's a reason why we underline that. I'll flag that in a moment, the reason. All we're doing is getting the concept. He married her. You say, well, sure he married her. All right? Just make sure we know that, because some don't know that. All right? Now, verse 18, let's get ready to flag something else. For John said to Herod, it is not lawful, underline that. He married her, Was it scriptural? Was it lawful? No. He married her, but it's not lawful. You say, what's the significance? Hang on. We're going to get to that. Now, Herodias, because John had said, you don't have a right to be married, that upset Herodias, as you know. Now, verse 20, he feared John, that is, he had respect for John. He thought he was a just man, a holy man, and he listened to him to the point he had done many things, and he was glad to listen to him. So if you can interview Herod, Herod, what do you think of John? Well, I have a lot of respect for John. What do you mean you respect? Well, he's a holy man. He's a just man. I think he's a man of God. Well, what about his preaching? Well, I listen to him a lot. I like to listen to him preach. I like his teaching. Have you ever made change? Yeah, I've made some changes in my life. I've done some things because of what I've heard from him. I've heard some of that. Seem to have some respect. Well, in interest of time, you might flag verse 22. That's Salome. He has this birthday party, basically a drunken bash. And he gets kind of loses his head here himself. And when Salome comes in and makes this dance before him, what does he do? Yeah, I'll give you whatever you want. And he goes so far as saying up to half the kingdom. Now that's kind of rash. He's rash and he's careless. He may have respected John. He may have had some faith and maybe John was raised from the dead, but he's foolish. He's rash. He's careless. And then when she comes in and asks, I want the head of John the Baptist, because her mother put her up to that. Verse 26, you might underline, the king was sorry. We often make promises and decisions and careless directions that later we look back and we regret. He was sorry. Wished I hadn't have done that. That was kind of stupid to offer her half the kingdom. So he sent and had him beheaded. And so I'm rushing through that. That's familiar territory. And that's the end of that story for the moment. All right. John the Baptist is beheaded. Now, I want to talk about this principle right here because you'll see Mark 6 right here making a point. Most of the controversy over divorce and remarriage comes because of a failure to distinguish between the marriage and the bond. And when that is not made distinct, that leads to erroneous concepts. I'm convinced of that. I believe I can demonstrate that. That's another story. Now, those who say the marriage and the bond are the same will often use this language. They'll talk about this person being married, and if it's an unscriptural marriage, they'll say, well, they're not really married. They're married only in the eyes of men. They're not married in the eyes of God. It's not a real marriage. And if they're divorced and it's unscriptural, well, they're not really divorced. They're still married, but they're divorced only in the eyes of men, but not in the eyes of God. That's foolishness. The Bible doesn't use that terminology. When God approves of a marriage, what does he call it? Marriage. When God disapproves, it's ungodly, it's unscriptural, they'll lose their soul over it, God still calls it a marriage. Evidence? Remember where you underlined? He married her. Was it lawful? It was not lawful. You underlined that too. More evidence? The woman which hath an husband is bound by the law to her husband. Verse 3 of chapter 7 of Romans, woman which hath an husband is bound by the law to her husband so long as he liveth. So then if, verse 3, she be married to another man, she should be called an adulteress. Remember that? Matthew 19 says the same thing. You put away your mate and marry another, you commit adultery. Marry another. Same thing with divorce. When God approves, it was called putting away. When God does not approve, what did he call it? Putting away. You say, I don't understand that. You get that distinction in mind, you're going to be able to answer most of the errors on divorce and remarriage. I guarantee it. All right, let's move on. Let's talk about the miracles that are recorded in verses 30 to 50. There are three. So let's see what we have in these miracles. We have the feeding of the 5,000. Now, we need to go back to the Sea of Galilee for a moment. Before we do that, we're going to come back to that slide. Don't get excited. I want to talk about the report. The apostles gathered and told all the things both that they had done and what they had taught. This is the report of going out on that limited commission. They come back and tell Jesus, here's the results we have. Here's where we went. Here's what we taught. Here's how we were received. And he told them to come to themselves to a deserted place and rest a while Because the crowd was so big, what's going on? They don't even have time to eat. The throngs of people are so great. So I gather from that that there was great success in a throng of people are following, not only because of Jesus, but because of the work the apostles have done. Now, a couple of things to flag here. This is the only miracle that's recorded by all four Gospels. Make sense? The only miracle that's recorded by all four Gospels. So here we have, on the third from the bottom, all four Gospels give a record of the feeding of the 5,000. What's the significance of that? I don't know. Just all four Gospels record that. Now, we have a little confusion over the city Bethsaida. And there is two on the map. There is one here of Bethsaida of Galilee and Bethsaida of Julius, which was on the eastern side, northern side of the Sea of Galilee. Now, Luke 9, verse 10, seems to indicate that where they went was Bethsaida of Julius on the eastern side. Make sense? You with me? This will make sense in a moment. So I take it what the event of the feeding of the 5,000 takes place over here in this region, close to this, not exactly it, because it was in the region of our land belonging to Bethsaida. And we're going to go to the other one in a moment, I think. So we'll see that in a moment. So they departed to the deserted place, and the multitude was there. They beat them to the other side. And when Jesus gets out of the boat, there's a multitude, and the disciples, after the day is spent, say, what about the people? Let's send them away that they may go to the markets and they buy food. It's late in the day. They're hungry. And Jesus told them, you give them something to eat. I'm reading it, verse 37. And so the disciples raised a question about that. That, in other words, that's going to take a lot of money to go buy. It's going to take 200 denarii. A denarii would be a day's wage for a common laborer. It'll take 200 denarii worth of bread. And are we going to go buy that and give them something? And so Jesus asked, I mean, what do you have? How much food do we have here? And they said, five loaves and two fish. Where'd they get that? From a little boy. What verse? It's not here. It's in John 6 and 9. They got it from a lad. So the parallel account does help us. They got that from a lad. Now, Matthew or Mark says, they sat down on green grass. He's the only one who mentions that. Just in, no play on words, that's a colorful description. but they sat down on the green grass. Now, the significance of that may be that they sat down in ranks. The word ranks literally gives the idea of garden plots, squares of garden plots. And they sat down by 50s and hundreds, perhaps to give the impression of how large it was, but also to create aisleways for the apostles to go among them to distribute the food. And so several describe it as, if you could see a square on the hillside, on the green grass, you see a square of about 50 people, and another square of 50 people, and another square of 50 people, and so they're in groups of 50 and hundreds, and totaling how many? Let's get down to verse 44. 5,000 total. Men. So, how many? I don't know, but that's counting the men. The Jews, generally, in numbering, would count the men. Doesn't mean the women aren't important. It just simply means that they didn't count them in the number. So, the number was larger than 5,000. We have practices like that. I was just talking to Tom a moment ago. If I ask Tom, how many cows do you have? He may say, I have X number of cows. Well, I've counted more than that. I counted around 100 more than that. Well, you didn't ask about how many cattle I have. See the difference? You're counting the men, but you're not counting all the others there. And that's how the Jews counted. But anyway, be that as it may, the number is larger than that. Perhaps 10,000 or larger are being fed. 5,000 was an amazing number. This is getting even more amazing. Yeah. So, when they get through feeding them, they divided among them all. Verse 42. What do we have at verse 42? They took up 12 basketfuls of fragments, far more fragments after feeding, let's just say 10,000 for an easy number. When they fed all this crowd, they have the fragments. And here's what we learned from that. Jesus has power over quantity. He has power over nature. We're going to see that. He has power over nature. He has power over quantity. All right, let's move on to the next miracle. Jesus walks on the water. Now they took the boat and they went to, verse 45, to Bethsaida. I thought that's where they were. There's another Bethsaida. Remember that? So they seem to be going from this eastern side to the western side toward Galilee. And John 6, 15 tells us that it was at this point they were wanting to seize Jesus and make him king. If he can work these miracles, he may help us to overthrow the government. He's not interested in that. They're going to seek to make him king. So he sent the disciples away. He went to the mountain to pray by himself. Now what happens? So this is happening in this northern part of the sea. He sends them on across over here to Bethsaida. And as they're making their way over, in the middle of the night, about the fourth watch, make a marginal note, that's from 3 a.m. to 6 a.m. That's the fourth watch. So this is the early hours of the morning. They're out in the sea by themselves. Yeah, he's going to walk past them, and as he's walking by, they were afraid. They supposed they'd seen a ghost and cried out, and he told them, do not be afraid. And is not mentioned here, Matthew 14 mentions something else significant happened right here. Peter said, if it's you, bid me to come to you. And he did. Remember that? And Peter walked on water. So you might flag right here in the margin, Matthew 14 says Peter walked on water about this point. All right? Then Jesus got in the boat with them. John says they suddenly then were at the land, which I take to be another miracle, but you may not. Now, verse 52 said they did not understand about the loaves because their heart was hardened. In other words, this shouldn't have been so amazing, Jesus walking on water, if he could feed 10,000 people. But they're slow grasping. Get the point? All right. One more section and we're done. Start at verse 53. What's going on in 53 to 56? Many were healed. They came to Gennesaret. What is Gennesaret? Or where is Gennesaret? Not a city, but a region. So let's go again to our map. They've come from Bethsaida here to Bethsaida here. And Gennesaret is on this region about a mile inland, a very plush region of land. They're in that region. And people came out and they recognized him, and they brought their sick. And people from the marketplaces, they laid them, if they could just touch the border of his garment. Quite a different reaction than we saw at Nazareth. Make sense? We're going to stop right there.